It's nearly 3 o'clock. You're listening to K2FM. I'm Ann Fuller, your host. Today on Juno Afternoon, we'll talk with Theater in the Rough's Aaron Elmore about their new production, The Ladies of the Camellias. Jesse Kaiser will be on telephone from Haines to give us details about next week's Southeast Alaska Watershed Symposium. We'll get a preview of this week's Wildlife Wednesday presentation about bats. And Jeff Reclos will give us an update on snow-related activities, the Writer's Almanac, music, and more. Wednesdays at 3 on K2. Tonight, it's raining. It's going to change to rain showers.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Washington State's new law allowing for personal marijuana use by adults won't be recognized on the Yakima Reservation. Steve Jackson reports from Spokane Public Radio.
The Yakima Nation has decided that despite the wish of state residents in voting to allow for marijuana use, they will not allow cannabis to be consumed or grown on the reservation. Tribal attorney George Colby says in part it's an issue of tribal sovereignty.
In fact, the state constitution, when the Washington Territory became a state, gave up right, title, and interest to Indian lands. We have the same exact opposition to the marijuana initiative as we had to the hard liquor initiative. We've stopped the hard liquor licenses from coming on the reservation because, again, the citizens of the state of Washington don't get to vote what happens on Yakima Nation lands.
Colby says marijuana is not a part of the Yakima Nation's culture, medicines, or traditions. He says the Treaty of 1855 requires the tribe to turn over those who violate laws of the U.S. to federal authorities. Since use of cannabis is still considered a violation of federal law, that policy will also remain in effect. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
The Cheyenne River Youth Project in South Dakota is celebrating its accomplishments. It started in 1988 and serves the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe with after-school programs, a local garden, and more. New projects include a restaurant and coffee shop. Charles Michael Ray has more.
Julie Garrow is the executive director of the Cheyenne River Youth Project. She says despite challenges, the organization has thrived over the last 2.5 decades.
We come from a couple of the poorest counties in the nation, and you know what we've been able to accomplish here over the course of our 25 years is remarkable.
Coming up this week, students will work with graffiti artists in the Lakota Voice Project to paint a large positive mural in Eagle Butte. Garrow says it's empowering for young people to express themselves through avenues like graffiti art. She adds that all of the programs at the organization helped to land the 2013 Community Service Award from the National Indian Education Association. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
In Canada, people in British Columbia are mourning the loss of a chief. The leader of the Musqueam First Nation died suddenly over the weekend. He was 72 years old. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
Ernie Campbell is being remembered as a tireless advocate and a powerful voice for First Nations in British Columbia. He had been involved in politics for more than 4 decades and was recently re-elected as chief of the Musqueam Band, a job he held for 14 consecutive years before stepping down last year. The band issued a statement over the weekend saying Campbell was a devoted husband, father, and grandfather, and was a strong pillar of strength in his family and his community. The band also says it mourns the loss of a great leader whose strong voice ensured that the Musqueam people's issues were a priority at provincial and national levels. Wayne Sparrow is the current chief and Campbell's son-in-law.
I don't think words can explain the leadership that he showed in our community on every aspect, soccer. He was a big pusher for education, graduating and making sure around the council table that our kids were educated and fighting for entitlement of the land.
Campbell was at the forefront of a landmark deal with the British Columbia government. That deal resolved 3 outstanding court cases involving the sale in 2003 and the relocation of several parcels of land the Musqueam claimed was in their territory. The land was eventually transferred back to the First Nation in 2008 as part of a reconciliation agreement that also included a $20 million cash payment to the band. It was also under Campbell's leadership when the band acted as First Nations host during the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
During this week in 2012, the Shinnecock Indian Nation, Mohegan Tribe of Indians, and the Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation declared states of emergency after Hurricane Sandy hit the East Coast. Among the things tribes in Sandy's path reported were power outages and damages to homes and buildings. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello, Aaron. You're in the studio to talk to us about a new play for November.
Yes. Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here. We are opening a play called The Ladies of the Camellias by Lillian Grogue. It opens Friday night. It's a comedy about two divas and a Russian anarchist trapped, sort of, in a theater in Paris in 1897. And so it doesn't take much explaining past that. Most of the time I've told people that, they just sort of smile and they kind of get the idea.
I see. So this is a theater in the rough production,
yes.
But it's not Shakespeare.
It is not Shakespeare. We didn't end up with a Shakespeare play this year. But we had a Shakespeare play in this slot. The production started sort of mushrooming around us and became more ambitious than we were actually ready to do at this time. So we decided to save that, put it down the road a little bit. And we've been doing this comedy that Katie and I have been talking about doing since we saw this at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival 20 years ago now. And we laughed and laughed, and so we thought, well, we really got to go. We really got to do this. It's a nice small cast. It's 9 people, so it's a very biddable size for us. And we've had this sort of in our back pocket ever since, and so finally the time came.
Sounds wonderful. And previews this week?
Yes, we had a first preview last night, our first of two previews. We've never done 2 previews in an opening week before. We all have day jobs, and we all work very, very hard. And so putting these together does tend to create a little pressure towards the end. We didn't find that this time. We thought, you know, here's a comedy. You know, one of the dangers of rehearsing comedy, of course, it has to have a fresh feeling to it. That's always best, and the audience feels like it's happening for the first time. The danger with a comedy and rehearsing it too long is that the actors can become a bit discouraged as they hear the director stops laughing at things that were funny a week ago, and you know, the stage manager stops laughing at that other bit that was funny 2 or 3 nights ago. And they get towards the end of this process, they really feel like, wow, this is not funny anymore. Well, of course it is. There's nobody out there to laugh for them. So have an audience come in, this sudden gush of energy. It's the last final component. It's the reason why we do it, of course. You know, if you can't have live theater without a live audience there sitting and watching, who have ventured forth into the rain and through the rain and into the doors and to sit down with their neighbors and rub elbows with them and find a seat and sit there in the dark and watch an actual play across that great divide between the stage and the audience. That's where the tension happens. That's where the miracle happens, as transportation, transformation, disbelief, suspended, all those miracles. So, to have the audience there last night was fabulous. It was wonderful to have some very familiar faces. It was also wonderful to see some people we'd never seen before, which is very, very nice. And if you're wondering out there in Radio Land, yes, we can see you, absolutely, across those. I'm not here in Radio Land, of course, but in live theater audience, you're only 72 people maxed in a crowd. You're only about 30 feet away. We see what you're doing, and we're very, very glad you're there. So we did have a preview. They very much enjoyed it. We hope to have another. We're going to have another preview tomorrow evening, Thursday, Halloween night. So if you're out and about, done trick or treating, come on down and see a funny show at 4th and Gold downtown. And then we'll open first Friday, along with everything else. We just have 3 new exhibits over at the museum. There's a bunch of other things going on in town, but we'll be opening tomorrow night, or Friday night at 7:30. The shows, and we'll run weekends all the way through the 24th of November.
So the month of November, we've got Theater in the Rough at McPheeters Hall.
That's right. And then on the 14th of December, we go to the Chilcat Center in Haines with our little comedy here, and we get to show it to those folks up the channel there. So that'll be very, very fun. We went up there last year with our production of Macbeth, and they were extremely happy we came, and very receptive and wonderful and warm and tremendous to us. So we wanted to go back, and here we go.
All right.
Yeah.
So we can see it in Juneau, and then it gets to go on tour.
That's right.
It sounds like a pretty successful rehearsal.
It has gone extremely well. I mean, one thing you can say for this comedy, it's brilliantly funny, and it's got some lovely ideas sort of set against one another in the midst. It's got some beautiful moments as well. It doesn't have a lot of sword fights or dances or any of those things that take us a tremendous amount of extra rehearsal time to get to. It doesn't have a lot of complex language that we have to sort of unpack with the actors and get on its feet. So we started staging right away, and it's sort of fallen into place. It's been a real joy.
That sounds like a wonderful addition to fall season here in Juneau, Alaska. And now I imagine you're still thinking ahead. There'll be a
always
spring season, too.
It will, yes. We're doing a show this spring. Another comedy, as it happens. It's all comedy all the time, Theater in the Rough this year. We're doing The Rivals, which by Sheridan, who's an English playwright. It's touted to be George Washington's favorite play. So if you think about going to see an all-comic version of Downton Abbey with George Washington as your date, that would be sort of the mood you'd be setting for yourself as you went to see this show.
I see. Well, you're giving us intellectual brain candy.
Well, I hope not. Yeah, it's a...
So tomorrow is November.
Yes.
Next month, we go to Paris.
That's right.
And can you tell us who's in this play?
Yes. Well, our two divas, very aptly cast, Katie Jensen and Denise Gott, who are absolutely, and they're two of the most generous and marvelous and wonderful performers you could ask for. They're not about attitude, they're about bringing this. But they have the chops and the gravitas to be able to bring these characters to life, which is wonderful. In real life, the two divas that they are, in fact, playing are Sarah Bernhardt, the divine Miss Sarah from France, and Eleonora Duza, who's from Italy, more or less Sarah's counterpart, equal in international fame back in the day, predating radio or television. These people, these two women, were known all over the entire world and came, of course, from dreadful circumstances, as lots of people did and do, and they are in the prime of their careers and somehow brought together by a concatenation of circumstances that have some historical basis. In theory, Eleonora Duza came to Paris to play her version of The Lady of the Camellias, which is a play by Alexandre Dumas, and there was no theater available, so Sarah Bernhardt offered the Théâtre de Renaissance for her to play Lady of the Camellias. Well, of course, Lady of the Camellias is one of Sarah Bernhardt's most beloved favorite roles, and so you have this idea together, and I think that's where Lillian Grogue kind of took this idea and sort of ran with it. And got clear out of the building and across the parking lot before anybody stopped her. Thank goodness, because it's a brilliant play. She includes Alexandre Dumas in the mix, although he would passed away, historically speaking, by this time. As the writer of the play, I don't think she could resist inserting a writer into the midst of this fracas, because someone there to complain about the fact that actors never actually say what you wrote or in the order in which they wrote them. And these two ladies in the theater with the author, then suddenly shows up a Russian anarchist. A Russian anarchist played by Dan Wayne, who isn't seen just talking very often. He's often singing. But Dan's been a great, and we've worked with him before in Julius Caesar, and it's wonderful to have him back. There's two leading men in the opposing companies as well, Zeb Bodine and Fisher Stevens, playing these two very, very vain, very sort of worldly young men who are part of Sarah's and Eleonora's companies, respectively. There's a prompter in the theater who sort of runs everything. He sort of is the theater. That's Phil Shemp, of course. We can't have the theater without Phil Shemp, who also, of course, worked many hours on making this rather tremendous set, may I say, which sort of took another direction with the Theater in the Rough play. There's an actual box set with walls and furniture and rugs and all kinds of things. You might not recognize what they are, but they're quite legit. It's really, really beautiful. Natalia Spengler plays sort of the young ingenue who sort of wants to be Sarah and Eleonora, and maybe sometime in the far-flung future. And historically, the young woman that she's playing, Gabrielle Rejane, did have a career and also rose to the sort of stardom that these two did. So there's a nice little insertion in there as well. I do show up towards the end. There's a sort of deus ex machina required. I couldn't resist. It was a chance to get to play the actor who played Cyrano de Bergerac for the very first time in history. And with that idea, of course, you get a chance to put on a pair of blue tights and swing on a rope. It's too fun to miss.
Well, it certainly sounds inviting, Aaron.
I think it's a gas.
And so this is a play that is at McPheeters Hall.
Correct.
Weekends in November.
That's right. Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, all at 7:30. The last two weekends, as we have done for many years now, we'll have two Sunday matinees. This year, they're on the 17th, or this time, this show, they'll be on the 17th of November and the 24th of November at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Your tickets are at theaterintheruff.org or at all the usual sites, the bookstores, the Jack, and at the door.
All right. Thank you so much for telling us about a great theatrical experience coming our way.
Thank you very much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 30th of October 2013. It was on this day, 1938, a cylindrical Martian spaceship landed in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, and began incinerating onlookers with an alien heat ray, an event that was covered by the Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations and caused mass hysteria in the East. Of course, it was a hoax. It was a radio play based on the H.G. Wells novel The War of the Worlds, presented by Orson Welles, the Mercury Theater of the Air. At the beginning of the broadcast, there was an announcement that what followed was a dramatic presentation was fiction, but many listeners missed the introduction and there was general panic, especially in New Jersey. It was estimated that of the 6 million people who heard that broadcast, about 1.5 million believed that it was true, and more than 1 million others were genuinely terrified. It's the birthday of the poet and critic Ezra Pound, born Haley, Idaho, 1885, championed the modernist movement and encouraged many writers, William Butler Yeats and Robert Frost, William Carlos Williams, Marianne Moore, James Joyce, Ernest Hemingway, and T.S. Eliot. It was Ezra Pound who edited T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland and cut about half of it out. It's the birthday of the journalist Robert Caro, born in New York City, 1936, who has spent the last 30 years writing a four-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson. It's the birthday of the second president of the United States, John Adams, Quincy, Massachusetts, 1735. John Adams, who said, "Democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There was never a democracy that did not commit suicide." It's the birthday of Fred W. Friendly, born Ferdinand Friendly Wackenheimer in New York City, 1915, went to work for CBS Radio and there met Edward R. Murrow, whose producer Friendly became. They did a number of news documentaries together for CBS News, where Fred W. Friendly resigned in protest in 1966 when CBS scrapped a hearing on Vietnam so they could run a rerun of I Love Lucy. Here's a poem for today by Joyce Sutphin, These Few Precepts, for Marna. I said to her, "Don't leave your life scattered in boxes across the country. Don't slip away without tying down the hatch. Don't walk a mile out of your way to avoid a crack. Don't worry about breaking your mother's back." "I'm sorry," I said, "that I was stupid when I married. I'm sorry I chose for right instead of love, for truth instead of beauty. They aren't always the same thing, you know, despite what Keats said. Don't try to do it all alone, and if you fail, think of how well you failed, and how all you really need is a good view of the sky, or a bit of something, a flower petal, or speckled stone, held close enough for the eye to drink it in. And remember, I said, I'll always love you, no matter what. A poem by Joy Sutphen, These Few Precepts, from her collection First Words, published by Red Dragonfly Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 3:20. You're listening to K2FM. Here in the studio for Juno Afternoon, I have Debbie Hart, the coordinator for the Southeast Alaska Fish Habitat Partnership, and Neil Steichert, habitat biologist with Fish and Wildlife Service, and the steering committee chair for the Southeast Alaska Fish Habitat Partnership. On the phone, we have Jess Kaiser, director for the Southeast Alaska Watershed Coalition. And all these folks want to tell us about a symposium coming up. Hello, Debbie. Are you going to start?
I will. And thank you so much. We really appreciate the opportunity to share an update with your listeners about the upcoming Southeast Alaska Watershed Symposium. This event is co-hosted by both the Southeast Alaska Fish Habitat Partnership and the Southeast Alaska Watershed Coalition. The event takes place next week at Centennial Hall, Monday, November 4th, beginning at 12:30 and runs through Wednesday afternoon, November 6th. We have a special evening social and poster event happening Monday evening, beginning at 5 p.m. in both the lobby area and the ballroom at Centennial Hall. This event is open to the public. We wanted to let your listeners know there's no registration fee, but we do encourage folks to register. And we have an online registration at AlaskaWatershedsCoalition.org, or there's also a link on the partnership website at seakfhp.org. So those are the event details. I'm going to let Neil give you a little bit of more highlights.
Thanks, Debbie, and thanks, Ann, for hosting us today. So as you introduced, I'm a habitat biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I have a very unique job. I work all over Southeast Alaska, helping fish cross underneath roads through fish-friendly culverts, and we fix up stream banks and restore wetlands where we can. This event really is a first since 2006 was the last time we hosted something similar of this magnitude for the Southeast region, and really highlight the practitioners and research and science and projects that have been occurring since that time. A little background on the Fish Habitat Partnership. It's really a nationwide construct of state and federal resource agencies, municipalities, tribes, corporations, and NGOs, all collectively working to share resources, align actions, and really speak collectively about the value and productivity of intact fish habitat, of which we have a robust amount and a great level of fantastic ability to preserve habitat in Southeast Alaska as well as restore it. So with that, we're really looking to get the word out about this event and invite the public to join us. We have three sessions, and we'll speak more about those.
Okay, thanks, Neil. And Jess Kaiser, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing well, thank you, Ann.
Well, great to hear from you, and we're ready to have you discuss a little bit more. Tell us more about our symposium.
All right, well, I will give a little background on the coalition and how we came together to partner with the Fish Habitat Partnership to engage conversations around fish habitat and aquatic resources in our region. The coalition, in coordination with its member groups, local leaders, and regional and statewide partners, strives to build the capacity of Southeast communities to carry out programs and projects that inform resource management decisions and encourage sustainable development initiatives. Over the past 5 years, community leaders and practitioners have emphasized to coalition staff and partners the importance of maintaining fish habitat and the function of important aquatic resources in and around their communities. So we believe it's fundamental to in building the capacity of local on the local level to advance fish conservation and informed aquatic resource management, to bring together and engage diverse stakeholders through presentations and discussions. By partnering with the Fish Habitat Partnership, we're able to bring together this diverse audience of stakeholders and provide them with the most up-to-date science tools, research, and policies as they relate to fish habitat and aquatic resource management in our region. And most importantly, probably for our local community leaders and practitioners, is to provide them with the opportunity to network on a greater scale outside of their isolated communities and engage in discussions. So that's the main point of us coming together to provide this this event to the region. And we can go into more specifics on the objectives. I think Neil's going to speak a little bit to the goals.
Okay, Jess, thank you. That's a great overview. And gosh, Southeast Alaska, fish. Of course we should be protecting the habitat and figuring out more about it. So I wanted to just clarify, there's sessions and lectures going on, and then there's this poster session too. All right.
Yeah.
Tell me more, Neil.
We have a diverse lineup. So starting early Monday afternoon, November 4th, we have what we're deeming session one, fish distribution and habitat inventory activities in Southeast Alaska. And we've got a great lineup of really diverse speakers from U.S. Forest Service, fisheries and hydrologists from Petersburg. We've got habitat division folks from Alaska Department of Fish and Game, as well as representatives from Alaska Department of Fish and Game Sport Fish Division. So everything from mapping fish distributions and all the way through some fantastic history on steelhead abundance and harvest patterns of fish across Southeast. And that's Monday afternoon. And what we do wind up is we roll into a poster session, an early evening poster session, where everyone, including the public, is invited. And it's more of a social, informal environment where we can walk through the lobby of Centennial Hall and peruse the great publications of our partners. So that event starts at 5:15 on Monday the 4th and concludes around 7 p.m.
All right. Thank you. And then it goes on because there's two more days?
There are. And on beginning at 8:30 on November 5th, we've got another session called Watershed Scale Prioritization, so not all activities can be done at the same time, so you have to prioritize and pick and choose amongst all the things you can do on the landscape. And so in these sessions, from 8:45 a.m. through noon, we've got a fantastic lineup of folks, again, from the Nature Conservancy, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Scott Harris is coming over from Sitka, from the Sitka Conservation Society, and we've got a great lineup of presentations for that morning. And we're hosting a lunch, so if all the registrants are able to come and join us for lunch, you'll hear Debbie talk more about the construct of the Southeast Fish Habitat Partnership and why we exist and what we plan to do in the near future. And then we're going to wind up the afternoon on Tuesday and Wednesday, basically showcasing new tools and emerging research and monitoring in Southeast Alaska. Here we kind of shift our focus from what we are doing into what we could be doing and should be doing into the future. So we bring in some more partners from the University of Alaska Southeast, the USGS from Anchorage, as well as the Nature Conservancy.
Excellent. So this is sounds like a fairly high-powered program of speakers and folks who have really thought about fish and the habitat we have. What more would you like to say, Debbie?
Sure. I think maybe Jess would like to share a little bit about our last day. The coalition has really outlined a really nice list of speakers and topics. So,
oh,
Jess, do you want to chime in a little bit about that?
Sure. Thanks so much, Debbie. The last day, November 6th, is a bit of a different it's more of a broader lens talking about aquatic resources, and not just specifically as they pertain to fish, but we think that it's incredibly important to highlight the Section 404 of the Clean Water Act, established a program to regulate impacts to the waters of the United States. And over the past 4 years, the coalition has been working to build an in-lieu fee mitigation program that offers mitigation through restoration, enhancement, and creation opportunities to Section 404 applicants. This effort has highlighted to the coalition that there is a very little institutional knowledge in our region on how the Section 404 regulatory program works and what actually constitutes effective mitigation. Are we achieving mitigation of the losses to aquatic resources that we're losing in our region? And I'm really pleased to bring the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, to discuss to participants and provide an update on the regulatory program in Alaska and how it's carried out in Southeast. In addition, we're bringing folks from the Washington State Department of Ecology in Washington and the Willamette Partnership in Oregon to share with us and the audience how these states have advanced their Section 404 regulatory program and share with us the tools and guidances and policies they've developed to support the mitigation of fish habitat and valuable aquatic resources across landscapes in those states. And then in the afternoon, after lunch, it's a great opportunity for participants to learn how in-lieu fee programs in Southeast Alaska are striving to mitigate these aquatic resources. So we'll have Gretchen Kaiser from the Southeast Alaska Land Trust talk about how the Land Trust prioritizes their projects. And then I will speak to the proposed Southeast Alaska Mitigation Fund that the coalition is working to develop, and how we are working to build that program in partnership with a vast number of stakeholders in our region. And we'll end that day with a workshop on that teaches participants and the audience what constitutes effective mitigation under this regulatory program, and how the public and partners can nominate and identify sites around the region that could potentially be carried out under the mitigation fund.
Thank you. So that does talk to an additional aspect of what can be done for watershed and fish, and it sounds great that you've had invited all these experts locally and then reaching out. So that Wednesday program involves people from other places and will help us go ahead. Could you go over the registration and the website so that if people want to get some of these details back in front of them, they can find them?
Absolutely. I'd love to kind of recap some of the whens and wheres and whats of the event. So again, this event takes place next week at Centennial Hall. It begins Monday, November 4th, about 12:30 in the afternoon, runs through Wednesday afternoon, November 6th. There is an evening social poster event that begins around 5:15, Monday evening, again at Centennial Hall. And folks are encouraged to register. There is no fee, but we do really encourage folks to use our registration so we know how many to anticipate. And you can find links for the registration at the AlaskaWatershedCoalition.org website, and also at our partnership website, which is our abbreviation. It's SEAKFHP.org, and that should take you to the Southeast Alaska Fish Habitat Partnership website. You can find a link there that will take you to the registration page. And we really encourage folks to come down. Enjoy these great presentations. It's a great chance to meet folks that are involved with fish and watershed topics around the region. So, again, thank you guys for having us here, and we really appreciate your time.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for coming to Juneau Afternoon.
What is a watershed? Hey, do you know? It's where water flows, it's through the rains or snows. It's the land beneath the feet where the water comes and goes. should is here and near all around. Starts on higher ground, then it runs on down. It's upstream, downstream, wherever our neighbors are found. And waters are where it all begins. Starts as a trickle, then grows real big. From tributary streams, rivers and lakes, ends up in a mountain. That's what the naturalists say. Well, what is a watershed? Hey, do you know? It's where water flows after it rains or snows. It's the land beneath the feet where the water comes and goes. Some watersheds are huge, sometimes they're small. Some begin in the mountains and drain near a mall. Some pass through a field, through a ditch, along a road, even empty in a storm drain, where lots of water goes. Well, what is a watershed? Hey, do you know? It's where water flows until it rains or snows. It's the land beneath our feet where the water comes and goes. Now keep the watershed healthy where you are. You'll provide a robust habitat near and far. Never be rude and dump out chemicals or petroleum crude. After a hot, hot rain and the waters flow and carries pollutants down to your neighbor's home. And then he rides. What is a watershed? Hey, do you know? It's where water flows after it rains or snows. It's the land beneath the feet where the water comes and goes. Farmlands, wetlands, cities and towns, places through which water runs down. Watersheds are homes for life of all kinds. Let's take responsibility and keep it all in line. Well, what is a watershed? Hey, do you know? It's where water flows up to the rains or snows. It's the land beneath the feet where the water comes and goes. Our watershed is here and there all around. Starts on higher ground, then it runs on down. It's upstream, downstream, wherever our neighbors are found.
Foster Brown singing about watersheds. Right now we're going on to a preview of this week's Wildlife Wednesday program. And Patricia, I'm glad to see you here. Tell me about Wildlife Wednesdays.
Hi. Wildlife Wednesdays is sponsored by Alaska Wildlife Alliance Southeast Chapter. And they've been offering this in the wintertime monthly for a few years. And we brought a presenter here. We're going to be presenting tonight.
Okay. So this is a show tonight out in the valley. And the guest speaker is Karen Blavis. And the topic is?
The bats of Southeast Alaska.
All right. So,
I've been researching bats for the past 3 years here in the Juneau area and actually across Southeast, so we'll be talking about some of the things that we've found out.
Okay, so the results of research presentations. I have to ask, are there lots of bats around?
More than you might think. There's actually four species in the Juneau area, and probably the most bats I've ever seen has been out at Fish Creek Pond, but I had to use night vision goggles to actually see, but there were probably a couple hundred bats foraging over the pond.
Wow.
Yeah, but if you weren't looking through the goggles, it was really hard to see even one.
All right, so this is a part of our wildlife that we don't, they're not that charismatic, I've got to get a picture of the whale, the bear. Are they all small? Are any of them small?
They're all small. They're really small. In fact, the smallest, the California myotis, is It weighs, adults weigh between about 5 and 6 grams, which a nickel weighs 5 grams.
Yeah.
So they're small.
That's very tiny. Okay. So, Patricia, are these lectures aimed at the general public?
Yes, they are. They're open to the public for free.
Okay. And can you give me exact place and time?
We'd love to. It's a new venue, so we're retraining people. And it's Thunder Mountain High School, which is out in the valley, on Riverside Drive for people who are hunting for a place name. We're in the library, which is on the second floor. You just come through those front doors, look up, and there we are, right up above you.
And so this is a lecture tonight?
It is, 7 to 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock at Thunder Mountain. And I'm just intrigued with the idea that there are bats around here. And what do they eat, Karen?
All the bats in Alaska are insectivorous. So they eat not only flying insects, though, but some of the species are also known to glean insects, like spiders and things, right off of the vegetation.
Oh. So. All right. So how intriguing. And how about some of the equipment you use? You said night vision goggles.
Well, we use, it's amazing for a species that is so small how much and how heavy the equipment is that we're constantly lugging around to study these guys. But we use bat detectors. We've got various brands of bat detectors that can pick up and record their echolocation calls.
Sure.
We also use radio. We put tiny little radio tags on the bats. And then we track them on the ground and from the air. We put out data loggers at their roost sites so that we know how long they're there, when they leave, how long they're gone, when they come back. So, it's lots of gadgets involved.
Well, that's how we do science and gain more facts. And and I thought, Karen, that we should say, too, who do you work for?
I work for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm the regional biologist for the Wildlife Diversity Program here in Southeast.
Thank you. And diverse wildlife, including the things we don't often think about. Although this is a great week. Did you set this up this way, Patricia?
I think somebody had it in mind when they were thinking
Someone had it in mind because there are bat silhouettes all over windows all over town now. And you can find out about bats and what they are like in the wild. So, anything else to say?
Love to have people come. We'll help you locate our place, and it's very comfy, our new spot.
All right. So, Wednesdays, the lectures are monthly. This week, it's on bats, and Karen Blavis talking about the bats in and around Juneau.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to look out.
Right, we're here on Juneau Afternoon. My name's Ann Fuller, and engineer and producer is Jeff Brown. Here in the studio, I have Jeffra Clow, and she's to talk about snow-oriented activities. And there's no snow on the ground yet.
There's no snow on the ground yet, but there is snow in the forecast up at Eagle Crest for starting tomorrow. We're keeping our fingers crossed it stays that way. But thanks for having me this afternoon.
Well, you're welcome, and Tell us what is going on this weekend.
Well, it is a busy week for Eagle Crest and for snow sports enthusiasts. One of the things going on tonight at Centennial Hall is Warren Miller's Ticket to Ride, and that is put on by the Eagle Crest Snow Sports School, and tickets are $12 at the door. Two shows, 5:30 and 8. And this is a great way to get excited about skiing and snowboarding and get ready for the season, get ready for winter, because we know it's coming.
Yes, we do know. There will be snow, and I'm sure people are getting geared up. Now, Warren Miller, that's practically a brand name in movies. What is it that makes it a great ski movie when you say it's a Warren Miller movie?
Well, Warren Miller started, he was the very first person that really took off with ski movies years and years and years ago, probably 60 years ago maybe. And so they're kind of an icon in the ski and snowboard world. And I've watched the preview on this one. It looks like it's going to have some great shots. They travel all over the world. They show some phenomenal skiers and snowboarders and some families, and it's just a good all-around movie that all ages enjoy.
That sounds great. And you're saying that's tonight?
Tonight at Centennial Hall. Uh-huh. And we have two shows, a 5:30 show and an 8 o'clock show. And tickets are $12 at the door. And it's a great evening. We're also selling season passes for Eagle Crest and taking photos. If you've already got your season pass, you definitely don't want to wait until the end. That very first day that we're open to get your photo taken. So,
well, no, when there's snow on the ground and the lifts are running, it's great to be all ready.
Yep, you want to be all ready. So we're going to be at Centennial Hall tonight, starting at 4:30, taking photos. If you need information on season passes or multi-visit cards, we have our early bird sale that's going on now through Saturday, November 2nd.
Oh, I think we need to get the details on.
Yeah.
So a season pass is good for as long as the resort is open.
It's good for the entire season. It's direct to lift, and you don't have to stop at the ticket window. You can you have that convenience to be able to go up whenever you want. And for an adult, an unlimited season pass is $519, and that price is good through Saturday, November 2nd. Okay. So that's our early bird sale. So we're encouraging everyone to get out there, get your season pass. Because we know that winter's happening. Summer was great.
Summer is gone.
It's gone, and now it's time to look at snow.
Okay. And then you were starting to say also besides season tickets, there's some other multi-day pass.
There is. We have something for everyone that will fit everyone's schedule. And all of this information, you don't have to remember it, is all on our website at skijuno.com. But we have multi-visit cards that if you don't think you're commit to an entire season pass, we have multi-visit cards. The nice thing about the multi-visit cards is they're transferable. So you and I could actually share a five-visit card, and we could bring Jeff along, and we could just have a great time. Those are really nice. We also have other options. Like an example is if you've never skied or snowboarded before and you've decided this is the year to go, we have what's called our Triple Play Learner's Pack, which is three lessons, three lift tickets, and three equipment rentals. And it's just for one low price of $119. So all this information is on our website at skijuno.com.
And that's where Eagle Crest puts out the details of how convenient it is to ski at our hometown resort.
It is. And we're so lucky to have Eagle Crest outside our back door. And winter can get long and tedious and in Juneau, as we all know. And it's great to sometimes leave the sea level and come up to the mountain where we always have snow.
You always have snow. That's true. So we were saying it's the week to be thinking about snow because it's in the forecast. There's a great movie tonight. And you said that the passes and photos for ski passes are available through Saturday. I think there's something else going on at Centennial Hall.
There is Centennial Hall on this weekend is the annual ski sale that the Juneau Ski Club and the Juneau Ski Patrol put on. So that's a great place if you're looking for gear, you're looking to buy gear, just find out information. That's a great place to go. And that is Saturday. Then doors open at 10 o'clock. And if you have gear that you're looking to sell, trying to turn over your gear, you can check in your gear on Thursday afternoon and Friday afternoon. Thursday from 4 5 to 8 Friday from 4 to 8, and then Saturday morning. And that information is also on our website at skijuno.com. But the ski sale, it's an annual event. It's a great time to come look for gear, sell your gear, find out information about Eagle Crest, and a lot of other vendors are there as well. It's just a great event.
A great event and a good way to get started on this winter season.
Yes, and it is coming, and we're, it's just around the corner.
All right. I do want to say that we're talking about Eagle Crest, we're talking about the ski club, but the website is www.skijuno.com. So Ski Juno, that's if you don't already have it bookmarked. I'm sure some people out there know exactly where that website
is. It is. And one other great thing that's happening, if we have time, is Eagle Crest and Juno were picked to be in Powder Magazine's Ski Town Throwdown competition. They picked 64 ski towns in the country or in the North America, and we were one of them to be picked. We made it through the first round.
I heard there was voting going on.
There was voting going on the 28th, and we beat Whistler Blackcomb, which is a very large destination resort in British Columbia. We beat them, so now we've moved on to the second round, and the second round of voting is November 7th. So we're just trying to get that word out to everybody to help us. This is a great, we are really thankful to the entire community that kind of gathered around and voted for us. And we trounced Whistler. So we are very excited by that. And it just shows that Eagle Crest is a very special place and Juneau is a very special place. And we're excited to tell the world that we are.
That sounds great. And yes, the loyalty we have for our resort and all the people who put in time. And so if you're starting to think about winter, this is a great weekend to kick it off.
It is. It is time. And even if you've never, don't know what Eagle Crest is, don't have any idea, never thought you'd be a skier, snowboarder, stop by Centennial Hall. Come to the movie tonight. We'll help you out. Come by Centennial Hall on Saturday. And we're going to have lots of people there to answer questions. If you're looking for a job, we're doing hiring right now. So, this is a great week to start really getting geared up because we know that white stuff's going to come soon.
I like that you're enthusiastic about the imminent winter, but it will be nice when the white snow covers our ridges and people will be skiing and snowboarding. So the movies tonight, the ski sales this weekend, it's just time to get geared up, isn't it?
It's time to get geared up. We're watching the forecast, and the weather is getting cooler. So that's something that we're excited about. And remember, if you haven't purchased your season pass, the early bird sale is on now through November 2nd. So you want to get that at a great rate. And just start thinking about skiing and snowboarding, because there's no better place to spend the winter than up at Eagle Crest.
Thank you, Jeff.
All right. Thanks for having me today.
This is Bird Note. If we had to pick one bird's voice to symbolize our eastern woodlands, the blue jay's voice would likely be it. Its familiar calls ring year-round through deciduous forests east of the Rockies. And, as a frequent visitor to backyards and bird feeders, the blue jay is among the most widely recognized birds of the region, as well as one of the most colorful. Its upper parts glint bright blue from the tip of the tail to the peak of its stylish crest. But when nesting, the same jays can be as stealthy and quiet as the most expert ninjas, sneaking to and from their nests with uncanny secrecy. And as familiar as the typical call might be, these birds are immensely creative vocalists with a large vocabulary of other calls, including piping notes. Rattles. And astute mimicry of birds of prey, such as the red-shouldered hawk. Writers for Bird Note include Bob Sundstrom, Ellen Blackstone, Todd Peterson, Dennis Paulson, and Chris Peterson. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Programming support comes from Balloons by Night Moods, offering new and used Halloween costumes for all ages. Balloons by Night Moods, located at 9342 Glacier Highway in the Valley. More info at 523-1099.
Perseverance Theater invites you to set sail for Treasure Island. Follow the adventures of young Jim Hawkins as he travels in search of treasure on the mysterious Skeleton Island and encounters fantastic characters such as Mad Ben Gunn, hideous Blind Pew, murderous Israel Hands, and of course, Long John Silver, one of the most charismatic anti-heroes in all of literature. With Anina Maynard Losh at the helm, Treasure Island is a sure find for the whole family. Opening November 8th. More information can be found at perseverancetheater.org by calling 463-TIXS.
Are you a discerning music fan?
Bad songs about the Irish smiles, what you got, the Tura and the Lura and more Lura. I mean, it's crazy. Sung by men with high voices.
Tired of the musically uninteresting?
Want me to sing some of that to you here?
Yeah, maybe later.
How much later?
Later.
Okay.
For the overly earnest?
I'll write songs, try to make the world a better place.
There's a contradiction here, partner.
We'll have you singing a different tune this weekend.
Saturdays at 4 on K2 News, Sundays at 11 on KRNN.
Uncle Jeff, what's that?
That, little Billy, is a record.
What's it do?
Well, it goes round and round, and music comes out.
Out of that little hole? Wow.
Remember, records, the KTOO used record CD and video sale is coming soon. Saturday, November 2nd from 9 a.m. till noon at the KTOO building at the corner of Egan Drive and Whittier Street.
That's the Cook County Blues Band, and they're going to be playing Friday night in Juneau at the Jack. Tomorrow, Thursday at 3 on a Juneau afternoon at K2FM, Shona Strausser will host. We'll find out about Jay Query's upcoming solo recital. Toby Harbinick will be here to highlight his First Friday exhibit at the City Museum. And we'll talk to Barbara Craver about her First Friday exhibit at COPA. And Nancy Turney will be here with Arts Up, That, Writer's Almanac, Music, and More, Thursday at 3 on K2 News. If you miss a Juneau afternoon or want to listen again, you can catch it and other local, statewide, national, and international news on the web at k2.org. This is K2 Juneau. It's 4 o'clock. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley in Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion in an Icy Strait. In Juneau, K2 is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at k2.org. Support for national programming on K2 comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. Our weather in Juneau, rain today, rain showers through Thursday night, rain on Friday, cloudy with a chance of rain. Saturday, mostly cloudy. And that's Juneau Afternoon on K2FM. This has been Ann Fuller with Jeff Brown on the board.